Why be like Eckhart and think about the future when you can think about the past? 25 years into the past, that is. Hey, welcome to the 75th anniversary Batman podcast celebration, with this week's focused on Tim Burton's 1989 spectacular, Batman.
Now you wanna get nuts? Come on, let's get nuts.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the 25th anniversary of Tim Burton's Batman podcast. I'm just going to come up with the name, Batshit Crazy. That was kind of floating around in my head, and I feel like that's very suitable. So thank you for listening. My name's Anthony Kudo. I write some stuff for IGN, but most of the time I live in Toronto with some lovely gentlemen here who are joining me today. Wonderful friends, mothers lock up your daughters. We have Dan Brio.
Hey.
Steve Cook.
Hello, hello.
Colm Whitford.
Hello.
And Griffin Tiplitsky.
Thanks, Tony. I'm here on the scene in Innsville, Ontario. People are just losing their minds over this Batman anniversary.
Batmania, as they called it, in June 23rd, 1989. People were so enthusiastic, they were shaving bat symbols into the back of their heads.
Wow.
That's intense.
It's very intense.
Yeah, especially without seeing the movie. It's kind of like in Fanboys when Seth Rogen's character gets the Jar Jar tattoo.
Oh, yeah. Good.
We'll talk about its impact as a whole, but I think just going around, I guess starting with you, Griffin, just say briefly what you thought of the movie and how well you think it holds up 25 years later.
Okay, I want to start off by saying I am the most ill-equipped to talk about this. The only experience I've had with Batman before is The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises, and The Lego Movie. And that's it. I had never seen this movie before, so I just watched it a few days ago. It's not great.
See, I picked Griffin specifically for this reason. I thought it would be my ultimate experiment, my human centipede, if you will, to see what Griffin thinks of it. Okay. So, Steve, what about you?
I'd seen it before, and I don't know if it holds up. It's certainly better than the Schumacher films, and I'd say it's on par with Batman Returns. Like, I don't know, like, Jack Nicholson's great as a Joker. He's definitely the best Batman villain before any of Chris Nolan's stuff, I think. It's not bad for the time. Tim Burton tries to balance the campiness and the kind of darkness and kind of get away from the Adam West stuff. So,
Dan?
It's not bad.
You know what? Rewatching it really made me think of how much of a children's film it really seems to me now. It really, like, I think I was really into it back when I was like 12 or 13. But, you know, after seeing Nolan's trilogy, it just, I just can't go back, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of cheese.
Yeah.
The real question is, do we think Christopher Nolan has seen that movie?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You think?
Yeah, you know what?
The guy doesn't have a phone. No, doesn't have a computer. What does he not have? I don't think he has a phone.
All of the above.
No, but there's something like that where it's, like, really hard to get in contact with him. You have to, like, meet in person or something like that. He's, like, super weird about that up here. Yeah, he's Batman.
He's
Batman.
He's a never nude, probably. Okay, Colm, what about you?
Colm's take.
You know what? After seeing, like Dan said, after seeing the Chris Nolan series, it's hard to look at it the same way. Like, Nicholson is an awesome Joker. I mean, this town needs an enema. Classic line. You can't beat that. Right. But it's just that, like, after I haven't watched it since seeing the Nolan series, so it was definitely a lot different than when I saw it when I was a kid.
Yeah, and you don't realize, they say son of a bitch in it and shit.
They say shit and son of, yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Also,
I thought it was not a children's movie after all.
Well, yeah. Batman Returns says, that was just the pussy I was looking for.
But that's more of an allusion, if you will.
Yes, it is a double entendre.
Yes, my favorite kind of entendre, I'll have you know.
I like the triple.
Well, basically, just to give a little overview, a brief history of the creation of 1989's Batman. Basically, this teacher from Indiana University, Michael Uslan, he was teaching the first ever comic book course, and he was obsessed with the early Dark Batman stuff and was so frustrated with how he had gotten to be the campy Adam West version. So basically, he set out when he was teaching this comic class. He was also a lawyer. He wanted to produce his own Batman movie. So he actually secured the rights with this other producer he met because he was working at United Artists. And so basically they were shopping around the rights to different studios, and they eventually landed with Warner Brothers, and it was sort of their passion project. So it wasn't quite Tim Burton that was the one who said, hey, we want a Dark Batman. It was this Michael Uslan. What do you guys think it accomplishes in terms of tone? You touched on it a bit, that it's not quite as dark as it's supposedly let on. But I guess compared to previous Batman stuff, what do you think? Were there times that you thought, like, okay, this is a dark movie?
Well, I just want to clarify one thing. Does Batman kill a bunch of people when he blows up that factory?
That's what we said!
Yeah. I'm pretty sure he does. There's no way anyone walked out of that factory.
No, that's
a weird scene in the movie.
Oh, Batman, he doesn't kill people himself. He doesn't kill them directly, but he's like, hey, if this factory happens to explode while you're in it.
Yeah.
What can you do?
Yeah.
Well, funny. He also says to the Joker directly, I will kill you, and has no remorse about it, and then proceeds to attempt to throw him off the bell tower.
Yeah, and you know what? He doesn't seem to feel...
He killed him.
Sorry, he doesn't...
Drop him into the bat.
You go. You got it.
Oh, great. He also thought he killed Napier by dropping him into the vat.
Yeah, well, that was an accident. He kind of gave up on that.
But he didn't really care.
Dropped him.
One big change that this movie did, which I guess we'll address right away, is that they had it so that the Joker, who was formerly Jack Napier, he was a gangster who actually shot Bruce's parents, Thomas and Martha Wayne. What do you guys think about this change? Were you aware that it wasn't in the comics that the Joker was the one who did this?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a poor choice. I prefer the other story where it's just like supposed to be just a random guy that he killed, because like it's a different kind of vengeance if you're actually getting the killer of your parents versus just like, you know, wanting to rid the city of crime because your parents were killed by some criminal who you don't know, kind of thing. So I think that kind of changes the story, and it's almost like that Spider-Man thing. You can correct me if I'm wrong, so I only saw Spider-Man 3 once, but wasn't the point of it that, like, Sandman was the one who killed?
Yeah, which was a ridiculous thing.
Or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
Either way, that one I felt the same way, where I was like, that's kind of stupid. It makes it this kind of one enemy who is the cause of, like, you know, his feelings of, like, you know, I don't know, depression or, like, vengeance or whatever you want to call it. And so to make it the Joker as that one guy, then it's kind of like if you get him, then he kind of could give up the whole Batman thing.
Yeah, and they just touch on it with that one really brief line where Joker says something like, aha, I created you and you created me. Right, but beyond that, there is no real exploration of the closure that Bruce gets for really killing the guy who killed his parents, right? Shouldn't that sort of wrap up his career?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It's kind of weird.
He doesn't seem like they don't seem to dig too deep into Bruce Wayne. Like, even when he drops Jack Napier off the balcony, there's no real like conflict of conscience after that. He just seems to accept that and move on. And then later, you know, he just says, oh, Alfred. Turns out Jack Napier's alive. What are, like, you know.
Yeah, but he could have been dead, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Jack Nicholson should only play characters named Jack. It really works well. Like, this one and The Shining, it's like people just naturally call him Jack. So I think they just changed character names to fit him.
That's probably where the cast of The Office got the idea to just name the characters based off the actors' names.
Yeah, sure.
What's his name in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? I think that's Jack, too.
I think that might be Jack.
Honestly, it probably is.
Anyway, so we mentioned Jack Nicholson. He actually got the role because they were he was obviously their first choice. And I guess Tim Burton and the producer, Peter Gruber, went out to Jack Nicholson's ranch to convince him to do the role. And it was a very easy conversation, apparently, and they were horse riding. And I guess Michael Keaton, he was the first casting that came out of the gate, and that really made audiences worry because they thought that this traditionally comedic actor was going to take Batman in another campy route and sort of go back to the Adam West style. So let's talk a bit about Keaton's performance. What did you guys think about him?
I was just going to mention real quick that I read that it was Robin Williams that they offered it to just to kind of bait Jack Nicholson into taking the role, because they were like, oh, we might offer it to Robin Williams, and then he took it, and then they like kind of took it away from Robin Williams, and then he was pissed and said that, like, unless they put like a formal apology for it, he'd never do a Warner Brothers picture again.
Wow. Yeah, apparently he turned down the Riddler for that in Batman. Yeah,
he'd never do the Riddler, and he'd never do another Warner Brothers, and then later they apologize, so I guess now we can do them.
See, it's interesting, because even to this day, I remember when Dark Knight Rises was coming out, Robin Williams, I think, was rumored again to play this villain, Hugo Strange.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, I don't know, people must just think that he captures sort of that insanity quality that Jack Nicholson and Jim Carrey have.
I mean, he is relatively crazy. He's definitely hyper. I don't know if that's what they look for in a villain.
Right. And then... we'll talk about, I suppose, my least favorite part, Kim Basinger. I just think her performance in the film is atrocious, and I think it's her fault. I think it's her fault that there really seems to be no chemistry between Keaton and Basinger. And I think Keaton's really trying, and he's got that whole Mysterioso thing behind his eyes, and he's kind of doing a subtle thing. But I find Vicki Vale is also super subtle. So you just have these two subtle performances that come off as a really boring romance. What do you guys think?
The one scene where she finds out he is Batman, neither of them react.
Yeah.
Alfred, like, brings her into the cave. She's like, oh, you're Batman. He's like, yeah, you found out. And that's it.
Yeah, I was kind of waiting for some kind of, like, acknowledgement of the fact that she's in the Batcave right now. And she does not seem shocked or surprised. She's just like, yep, this is happening. I'm okay with this.
He's just like, you want a beer? Or...
Yeah.
Yeah, and how about that scene where he takes, well, when he first takes her into the Batcave, when Batman does, and he's trying to kind of hide his face, and she keeps kind of looking over, and he's kind of like crouching down.
That was, oh man, well, did you notice that he's got a light specifically in the Batmobile to blind someone?
Does he?
Yeah, watch that scene again. When she's in the Batmobile and she keeps looking at him, he turns on a little light that shines right in her eyes. Like, specifically for that purpose. I never noticed that before this time watching this movie.
Wow. I hope that doesn't exist in real life.
Lights that blind you?
Well, lights that are specifically designed to take people home with you and blind them. One beautiful supporting role was the graceful performance from Billy Dee Williams as Harvey Dent. What did we think about that?
It's go ahead.
It starts out, he gives like a big speech at the beginning, and you're like, wow, Billy Dee Williams, Harvey Dent, here's one of the biggest characters of the movie. And then that's it.
Yeah, that felt like more of a cameo than anything else, really.
Yeah. It's funny because I hadn't seen it in so long, I honestly couldn't have told you that that was who Billy Dee Williams played in the movie. I knew he was in the movie, and then I was watching it now, and I was like, okay, the credits, Billy Dee Williams. It starts, and then they said Harvey Dent, and I was like, Two-Face is in this movie? And of course he's not, and like, it's such a minor role that it's like, why does he need to be Harvey Dent, and why did you need such a big actor for that?
He hardly made a dent.
Oh. Ah.
You're cutting out.
I find, yeah, man, I heard he promised, or he was promised to actually be able to play Two-Face, and that's why he took on the role of Harvey Dent, but you can tell there could have been some stuff edited out, or there was at least a draft where they had more hints, because he really could have been anybody else. They had no indication of Harvey Dent in anything, really.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, like, the cops are nobodies. I don't really know the actor who plays the journalist guy that Griffin was talking about earlier. Again, I forget his name. I'm sorry, it sounds unprofessional, but also the journalist guy. None of them were big-name actors, and most of them probably had more lines than Billy Dee did. So what do you do, right?
Yes, well, another wonderful shining star was Pat Hingle as Commissioner Gordon. Pat Hingle is one of the rare Batman actors. Him and Michael Goff, who played Alfred, they're the, I believe, the only two actors to be in four straight Batman movies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pat Hingle, narrator from The Land Before Time?
Is he really?
I believe so.
Someone get on that. Someone get on that.
Yeah, no. Quick Google search. Here we go.
Anthony.
Yes.
You're talking about how that one man secured the rights to Batman earlier on.
Yeah.
I'm curious, how did Tim Burton get involved?
Oh, well, basically, Tim Burton had just started his feature filmmaking career. He had worked on Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And I believe while he was working on Beetlejuice, so in 1987, I think that's when he was offered the role. And or not offered the role, offered
Batman.
Yeah. Turned it down. Said, "No, I'm going to direct it."
Yeah, when he was offered to direct it, but he says, "I was watching the Batman Blu-ray special features today." He said that he wasn't confirmed officially as director, even though he was working on it, until they saw that Beetlejuice was successful.
Wow.
And Beetlejuice, of course, starred Michael Keaton, and that's where they got the idea to use him again.
I see. Okay.
Sorry, you asked before about Michael Keaton, and we kind of got off it. I think that might have been my fault, but I think he's good. And as you were saying, he's good for what they were trying to do with this one, and kind of have a dark and slash comedic balance. And because like it would be pretty jarring to make that jump from Adam West to something like Nolan-esque, where it's just like mostly serious, like I think that'd be pretty ridiculous, and of course there is a little humor to it, and I think he plays it well.
He was a good Bruce Wayne, but I don't know about Batman.
Yeah,
even Bruce Wayne, and this is going to sound a little bit strange, but the one thing I've always wondered about the original Batman, well, the Batman and Batman Returns certainly, is Michael Keaton. This is going to sound weird, but is he handsome enough to be Bruce Wayne?
Yeah, I see where you're going with that. He's supposed to be like a young playboy bachelor to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I saw Keaton as very neurotic and subtle in this movie.
Yeah.
It was definitely an interesting take. But the scenes I enjoyed most with him was when he was just sort of an uncomfortable person, like the scene where he was having dinner with Vicky Vale and the whole how's the soup thing and pass the salt. That I really enjoyed that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
That table was so long.
How long was it?
Hey.
Go ahead.
Yeah, apparently Keaton has not seen Batman Forever or Batman and Robin. I don't think he saw Batman Begins, but he said he saw The Dark Knight and very much enjoyed it.
Oh, okay. Because in my mind, Batman, or Bruce Wayne, he's a panty dropper, you know? He's a playboy. He's got it all. Like, yeah. And I feel Christian Bale was very, very good in both portraying that playboy and being serious when he needed to be.
Yeah.
You know, and then you have George Clooney on the other end of the spectrum, who is, you know, obviously a great-looking guy, is George Clooney, but not a great Batman.
You know? So it's a toss-up.
Yeah. Yeah, in terms of careers, I'd say Keaton's more the shower and George Clooney's more the grower. What do we think about the Prince choice for the soundtrack?
I have mixed feelings about every scene where the Prince songs are featured.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I guess that's just all two scenes, but the parade scene especially.
It goes on for so long.
Yeah, it goes on for way too long.
With it's like distant Prince song playing as like Money Rains, and it's almost just like it's a whole Prince music video.
Interesting fact about that scene, though. Apparently, there was a draft written where Robin and his family were in that scene, and the Joker shoots his parents. So not only does he create Batman, he would have created Robin as well.
Does he say the line like he promises he would?
He like shouts it after them.
Yeah. I forgot to say it again. Keeps forgetting.
About Prince, though, he made all those songs just for the movie, right, Anthony?
I believe so. And he only used, I think, 3 or 4 songs in the movie. Those were the ones he created for it. But then he released a concept album that was all kind of based off the sound of the movie, I'm pretty sure.
Does this mean in this universe, Prince is working with the Joker to make music for him?
No, I think in the universe, Prince...
Boombox, right? That's Prince?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Prince is making new music for the Joker. They're working together.
You that heard it here, folks.
Is just hilarious. Yeah, like the big mustache.
Yeah, Dr. Eggman.
Is that actually his name?
No, I just...
That's from Sonic.
Yeah, from Sonic.
Oh, okay.
I got it.
Fair enough. And so anytime people like enter a place, like everyone's, you know, doing stuff, and then he just has to stand there holding the, like, you know, boombox that only has a Prince cassette in it, I guess, that just plays wherever they go.
Think about that image, though. Prince holding a boombox.
It's not him.
Okay, so sorry. the guy with the mustache holding a boombox that's playing Prince. The whole film just reeks of the year it was made, you know? It's so...
Yeah, fair. Jack Nicholson's good as a Joker, though. They do enough of, like, the, like, he would be kind of, you know, making fun of the situation, or he'd, like, kind of enjoy that Prince is playing. That's why I agree with Colin, where you're, like, kind of torn on those scenes, you know what I mean? Like, the Joker would be, like, trashing a place while Prince plays. Like, he'd be totally cool with that. That makes sense for the character, but I don't think it fits, and it just kind of makes it seem so weird to me just to hear the Prince behind it.
You know,
I think
it feels dated.
Yeah,
well, the Danny Elfman score is just so much better.
Yeah,
that's the thing. They're so different, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, and it just, I find it just fits so well that you're just like, I don't know, use it a little bit more for like some epic scenes and take out some Prince stuff, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Even the way Tim Burton designed, or whatever the production designer, the way they created Gotham City for the movie, everything's sort of old-timey, the way the journalists act, like it's very old-timey. But then you have an 80s soundtrack, right?
Yeah, true.
and for me, it seems like it was a lot of really good ideas that they probably had for this movie, and you can tell because it took 10 years. They were just like, what are all the things we want in a Batman movie? But it seems like they didn't really flesh out the story itself. They were just like, Batman needs to be dark, so we're going to make him dark. Batman needs to have a line about his parents, so we're going to have a line here about that. It's just nothing really felt like there was payoff or not.
There was a story for the Joker. He had a whole story. And then just interspersed, there's like scenes to remind you that Batman is also in this movie.
Yeah.
Well, the Joker's kind of origin, if you want to call it that, story is pretty lame. I mean, given how insane he's supposed to be kind of thing, I think it'd be better just to not address it. And you can only imagine the kind of like tortures that has been in this guy's life kind of thing that would cause him to be, you know, so insane at this point when Batman meets him kind of thing. You know, I always kind of thought of that.
So like The Dark Knight?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where like he has these mixed up stories about like, who knows, was it like a alcoholic father, or was it, you know, his wife or whatever. Wife didn't love him because of the scars or whatever. Like, it's kind of cool that he was twisted now, and you can only imagine what would have got him to that point. This is like, really? Like, he's just insane now. Like, I guess he kind of was a criminal before, but like, still.
He's just becomes a dude who fell in chemicals.
Yeah, and he was a criminal before, and so a criminal again, but now he's like a complete nut job, and it just, I don't know, it doesn't really fit.
Yeah, and I mean, the way that they run it in the comics a lot of the time as well, I think his line is, if I'm going to have a past, I want it to be multiple choice. And that's why he always changes his story. And I think that was something that they did really well in The Dark Knight, right? And so giving him an origin story, like Steve said, it is kind of like disjointed. Like, how did he become this unhinged, falling into chemicals?
Yeah. Also, I guess at this point, with the Adam West show and the comics had been around already for a number of years, number of decades, people had already had the Batman origin ingrained in their head. But I wonder, if someone knew absolutely nothing about Batman, if they could have understood his motivation, why he was dressed up as a bat, like just from watching this movie.
You know what?
No.
As
someone who does not know the Batman origin story, no, you don't get that.
I thought that they really didn't explain any of that well. For being the like kind of first Batman movie, in like, you know, this kind of new revamp for Batman, it was very much like, here's this character Bruce Wayne, and like, here are these little hints at Batman, but they never, or like, not never, but like for the first, you know, half hour, whatever, they never say like Bruce Wayne equals Batman and like this is how he became him. There's just like the hints with the parents stuff, and that all comes later. And for so long, you might not even know that like the two of them are the same, you know what I mean? Unless you knew all the backstory.
Mm-hmm. It's as though they just go under the assumption that if you understand that his parents were killed, then he must become a superhero.
Yeah. Right. I think another big part of that, that they don't do well in this film, is they didn't really talk about how important the Waynes are to Gotham. I felt like Gotham wasn't important enough. And in Batman Begins, they make a point of really presenting the Wayne's legacy in Gotham, you know, and mm-hmm. and Bruce's father and everything like that, you know?
Yeah, is Wayne Enterprises even mentioned in...
Not that I recall.
Yeah. No,
reporters whose job it is to know things and look them up did not know about Bruce Wayne. They had to look up that his parents were murdered.
That's very true.
And also didn't recognize him when he was, like, right there at the party. She was like,
yeah,
you know Swain is, and he was like, no. And then she was like, okay, see you around, and then runs into him later, still doesn't piece it together, and like, what, before you said you weren't Bruce Wayne? Oh my god.
Yeah, and that goes back to where the hell does the chemistry come from between them? Where why are they supposed to be together, right? We don't really see that sort of headed off. It's all of a sudden she's back at his place, they're having dinner. And then suddenly Alfred's telling stories about Bruce as a little boy.
Yeah, right. Seriously, I agree with Griffin there. It's literally, it's all Alfred.
Alfred's I want him as a wingman.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, he's the one putting the moves on.
He becomes a night wingman later on.
Wow. we have almost covered all of the supporting characters except the despicable and one of my favorite parts of the movie, Mr. Lieutenant Eckhart, as played by the groveling, slovenly actor William Hootkins. This is the, of course, the goon who works for the police force. In every Batman movie, there needs to be a corrupt cop, and Eckhart is the one in the '89 movie. And he has such a gravelly voice that you can tell there was ADR over his voice in certain scenes. That he was just so overweight that it just overtook his vocal cords. Yeah, so do you guys remember much about Eckhart from the movie? He kind of stands out for me.
He's a terrible cop. He's all these like bums have been telling him that there's like a guy dressed as a bat, and his response is, they're drinking Drano. And even the other cop is like, I don't know, it's pretty weird. They're all saying this. He's not a good cop.
Consensus.
Yeah, I think we can agree. Also, remember when Gordon gets a call at Bruce Wayne's place that there's a tip that the gangsters are going to be at the chemical plant? Gordon asks, who's on the case? And then his cohort says, it's Eckhart, sir. And then Gordon goes, oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not Eckhart.
Yeah, facepalm.
It's like he should be demoted or fired or something if you don't want him on the most important cases. You have the authority to take him off of them.
Yeah. He's a great traffic cop.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is weird how he's already commissioner and he's done nothing to like they're trying to clean up the streets, but he's done nothing to get rid of the dirty cops that are working for him.
Yeah, even when they're trying to figure out what the source of the Joker gas is, which to me seems like Bruce's very similar or very simple detective work that any forensics unit could have done. But when they're trying to figure out where the poison gas is coming from, there's one scene in the mayor's office where the mayor's yelling at Harvey Dent to basically find the source of it, and he's like, I'm working on it. And we don't see any more work from the police department.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
That's funny. Well, on the subject of that, they had the news reporters who, for whatever reason, just aren't using their teleprompters for a lot of it. If you watch like just the first couple newscasts, they keep looking down at like the pages in front of them. And then finally there's like one of the guys who's just like staring right into the screen and talking. So many of them, you can see them like keep looking down at their pages. Did they not have teleprompters in 1989? They did, right?
I don't know. I'm thinking back to Anchorman 2. I feel as though they might have.
They definitely did, right?
Yeah, totally.
You were thinking back to Anchorman 1?
That's true. That's too far back. Only the sequel counts.
Once the sequel comes out, I just forget the first one.
Yeah.
Okay, but these, back to the inept cops. They none of them know what they're doing. Where are they during the parade scene?
That's when, very true. There's no police presence at all.
There's no cops.
Also, what happens to them when he goes and picks up Kim Basinger and the Batmobile unshields, drives off, and you notice two cop cars are chasing it? And by the time it gets to him, this self-driving car has lost two cops. Wow. Do that.
And when the bell comes down at the end, it comes down the church and it blocks the cops. They try for a second to unstick it. And then I think it's Gordon who just goes, "Eh, let's get out of here."
Also, at the end, they're so accepting that they're terrible cops that Gordon's like, "We have a bat symbol, so now we have something to alert people if crime is going on." Oh, God.
I agree with the Prince money-tossing scene. Is like such a blatant, "Hey, I'm the Joker. I'm the one who's been doing all this, and no cops are around."
He already went on TV and said he was poisoning the products.
Yeah.
The citizens,
they know it's him.
The citizens are also very quick to just forgive him for that.
Exactly. Yeah. He goes on TV, he kills people and says, "I did it." Then he goes, "But now I'm giving out money. Come on down." And they do.
Free money show.
Yeah, also at the very beginning of the movie, the mayor makes an announcement to the entire public that they need to take down Carl Grissom. If you're confident enough that you can tell the entire public that you need to take down a man who's within your jurisdiction, you should have enough evidence to take him down.
That's very true. There's one more thing about that parade scene. Do you guys think that all bat planes come equipped with balloon cutters? He's like, he's very prepared for that. He has a special little gadget that cuts them right when he's right out of range of the city. I just thought it was a little bit weird.
I don't know. I'm sure it's like an all-purpose cutting section.
But he also managed to harness those balloons really well. I don't know.
It has like this advanced targeting system. It has machine guns, misses the Joker completely. He pulls out a pistol, giant pistol. One shot takes down a plane.
Yeah.
Also, the pistol that big, even still, having seen this movie before, I just expected a bang flag to come out of it. So, I didn't expect it to actually do anything.
During that whole parade scene, he had that giant gun in his pants while he was dancing.
Well, that and something else.
Yeah, true.
Also, Batman shooting at him from the Batwing or Batplane or whatever you want to call it. What was he hoping to accomplish there?
He just shot at him and it exploded around him.
Yeah.
But he's again not supposed to kill or doesn't kill.
I don't think that this Batman has that same kind of stigma.
Wait, actually, in the comics, he doesn't kill?
No, he never kills in the comics.
Because he's a murdering machine in this movie.
Exactly.
What was he hoping to accomplish there? Was
he trying to kill him? Because how'd he miss? They're rockets, and he's a guy standing in the middle of the street.
There was a targeting system on the plane, and it zeroed in on the Joker.
It was the Target logo, for the Walmart / Target, the store. It was like that, and it just went around him, and it's oh, we should hit him, and it goes on either side of him.
Horrible.
It was the 80s.
Target systems were not up to par in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll probably start wrapping it up here, but I think overall, why don't we just kind of discuss if we think it was a positive step in the right direction and if we'd still sort of have our kids watch it. I know that's sort of an ambiguous question, but just sort of where you leave it, would you say this is a Batman movie in the upper half of the good Batman films, or would you say it's one of the weaker ones?
Well, just before we do that, I wanted to close one loose end here. Griffin was correct. The narrator of The Land Before Time was also Commissioner Gordon. Just 1 year before, Martin Hingle, Pat Hingle, he was the narrator in Land Before Time.
That was the greatest movie.
That's awesome. Was he for 1 through 13 or however many there are?
According to Wikipedia, only 1988. Only the first Land Before Time.
And he was sacked?
The only one that matters.
Okay, so going to go around with our final thoughts on Batman 1989, famous last words. Start with you, Mr. Griffin Toplitzky.
The music was good.
You don't even give Keaton a thumbs up?
Yeah, he was good.
It's because he pouts his lips so much, isn't it?
Oh, we didn't get into this. Can I? Batman's fighting moves. He stands there the whole time. He doesn't move. Maybe he'll throw a punch. Maybe he'll get shot and fall over. But that's it. That's he just stands there.
Also, why do the henchmen wear sunglasses?
Sure. Who's the 80s, man?
Can we talk about how dark the film is? I know we said
it's like, so dark. Not yeah, dark but like movie, literally but dark.
Literally, it is literally so dark. Like,
what a brave choice to not be able to see the climax.
Yeah, it's a really progressive filmmaking technique where you can't see any of the final fight, or anything that happens in the last half hour of the movie, because it's just all like pitch black. I had the brightness all the way up on my computer trying to watch the movie.
You know what I think part of the reason that that is Keaton did very little of the stunts. They were probably just trying to hide his face the whole time.
Oh, did he? Really?
And well, I wonder if they had to get someone with the same stupid like triangular eyebrows and pouty lips.
It's just funny to me because he's like, you know, older. Like he's not like the young, spry, kind of like jacked Christian Bale, so like that makes sense that his fighting moves are just gonna stand there, let them flip around a bunch, and then he punches them once
or gets shot.
I'll
fall down a lot.
No one ever shoots for his head. If they do that, game over for Batman.
That's what I said earlier. In every movie, if you just shoot them in the head, there's no like surprise. I had this in front of my chest. Yeah.
There's just one scene he has that little silver plate, and Jack Nicholson manages to hit it.
Yeah, exactly. But if you just shot him in the head, the whole movie's done. The whole franchise is done.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's just for movies in general. But that's,
I guess those are my final thoughts. Next.
All right, Colm, what about you?
You know what? It doesn't hold up as well as I thought it. As I thought it would the first time that I saw it when I was a kid. But Jack Nicholson's performance is always going to be a classic one. I mean, like I said, this town needs an enema. I'm going to remember that line till I die. And it's probably my final words.
All right, Dan Brio?
You know what? It by today's standards, especially after having seen Nolan's work, it does come off as being a little campy. But I think its legacy is very important to consider. After the Adam West Batmans, this one really got the ball rolling. You know, it really started to make people think about what they could do with the character with regards to cinema. And so I think it was very important in Batman's evolution in film.
I think that's pretty well put. They're definitely going a step in the right direction for sure. They saw the roots of the character. They just should have worked on that script a little more.
And Michael Keaton was great. He was a good call.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. Steve, you kind of shared some, but if there's sort of a concluding thing.
Oh, two quick things I'm going to mention, because there are two things that Griffin mentioned. It's funny, on IMDb goofs, because I thought I'd read one before, and it does say it here. It also says the thing that Griffin says, that the Joker says to Bruce, that he always asks, ever dance in the devil with the pale moonlight, to all his prey.
But Bruce does it twice to the same person, and that's it.
He's the only one that he says it to, so that's funny that they also put that in there. They also said that the plate that Bruce is examining in Vicky's apartment, it has that indentation in it before the Joker shoots it.
Interesting.
That's a continuity error that I guess you can go back and look for. That's funny because just we're just talking about the plate. But that's a side note. I agree with Dan Brio that the film is it's cheesy and it has its lame moments, and that's why we could kind of rip on it for all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, it was definitely better than Adam West stuff and definitely better than Schumacher stuff. So it was an example of, you know, what you could or should be doing with Batman. And I I'm sure Nolan must have saw it. He wouldn't have just, I don't think, jumped in without watching any of the old ones, especially not that one, because it was kind of darker than the Schumacher ones. So.
Right.
Just really quick on that note, they actually took the scene in Batman Begins where Commissioner Gordon, like, talking to young Bruce Wayne and comforting him. That actually came from a cut scene from this movie, apparently.
Really?
Yeah. So he must have seen it, or at least heard of this movie, right?
Well, even, Flass from Batman Begins, he looks a lot like Eckhart. He's basically a similar, just fat, bad cop.
Yeah. It's true.
And the Batwing scene where he misses with all the, as funny as it is that he misses with the target right on him, that is very like in the Dark Knight. It's kind of reminiscent there when Batman's charging the Joker.
Oh, it's funny. I was gonna just say quickly in the Dark Knight when you see the like awesome 18-wheeler flip, it's so funny in this one to see as part of the call the like. Car chase culminates with like this, you know, truck of vegetables that like kind of tips a little bit. Just so lame in comparison to the awesome scene in Dark Knight of their car chase.
Well, and you look at Tim Burton's career since then. Has he ever really had an explosive car chase? Right?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, fair enough. But it was just funny to me that they had these two different Batman car chases and one of them just has like a truck kind of tip over some veggies.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and just to end up my thoughts, I've always respected the movie and I have lots of fond memories for it. Obviously, it doesn't hold up that great. But Batman Returns, for me, still holds up as an awesome movie, and maybe we'll have to record something about that. I just feel like that's Tim Burton really doing Batman well and trusting the source material, but more so trusting himself and what he can do with the character, not so much shoehorning these fanfare moments, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Right on.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining me, gentlemen. I guess you could share your Twitter handles. I am Anthony Kudo at Anth Kudo.
I am Dan Brio at Dan Brio. That's spelled with an X at the end.
I am at Steve Cook 58. I believe that's what it is.
I think so. Actually, no. Yeah,
I think that's it's something like that.
I'm at Toplitsky, but I don't really tweet. It is my birthday in 2 days, so be sure to post on my Facebook wall. Just let me know to have a good birthday. Colin?
Yeah, I'm at Colin Whitford. Good luck spelling that one. You'll never find me on Twitter.
Okay, maybe I'll write it up into the article.
I'd rather be anonymous now.
Okay.
I'm swathed in shadow. They can find me if they look hard enough.
All right, everyone. Thank you very much for listening, and have a very happy Batman 75th anniversary in general. All right. See you later.